Welcome back to Not Too Busy to Write. I'm Penny Winsor, author and book coach. Today, I'm in conversation with Francesca Siegel, author of Welcome to Glorious Tuga and Island Calling, the first two novels in a trilogy set on the wonderfully fictional South Atlantic island of Tuga de Ora. Francesca talks with me about playing God in a fictional world, her deliberate choice and desires to create a refuge and a world not without challenges, but incredibly hopeful. We also talk about the influence of 19th century novels on her work and the joys and constraints of writing interconnected novels. We also talk about her memoir Mothership, set over the 56 days Francesca spent with her newborn twin daughters in intensive care. Published in 2019, this is still one of the most powerful memoirs of motherhood I've ever read. And we talk about Francesca's decision to write about such a personal story, something she never imagined she would do, and why it turned out to be one of the easiest books she ever wrote. Welcome to Glorious Tuga and Island Calling are out now. This series of the podcast is brought to you by award-winning UK-based audiobook app Zigzag. As you all know, I'm so obsessed with audiobooks, and it is brilliant to have the option to choose an independent audiobook app that is subscription-free and an ethical consumer best buy. Don't forget that Zigzag, that's X-I-G-X-A-G, has a special offer for Not Too Busy to Write listeners to have their second book completely free using the code TOOBUSY. All of the details are in the show notes. Thank you so much to Zigzag for sponsoring the series. That is it for Series 11 of Not Too Busy to Write. I hope everyone has a wonderful Christmas break. I'll be back in your ears in early 2026 with Series 12. Don't forget that if you are a writer who needs a bit of support and community to help you get the writing done, come on over to my writer's membership, The Fold. The links are all in the show notes. Enjoy the episode. Francesca, thank you so much for being with me here today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, I am so excited to talk about these books with you. I'm so excited. But first of all, I would love it if we could just quickly start with introducing the listeners who haven't read your fantastic books set on Tuga de Ora. If you could just introduce the world to us a little bit first.
The Tuga trilogy is set on the tiny tropical British overseas territory of Tuga de Ora, in sort of the middle of a very empty body of the South Atlantic. And it's a tiny, very close-knit community to which the main character, Charlotte Walker, comes. She's a London vet and a conservationist, and she has been sent to the island for a fellowship to take care of the very rare population of gold coin tortoises on the island. And as the first book opens, she's coming only for a year, only for this very specific conservation project. But the community there have never had a vet before, and they are not about to let her mess around with tortoises when they could lure her to their farms to take care of the dogs and the donkeys and the cows. So she's sort of pulled between her conservation mission and the work of a farm vet quite quickly.
These books came to me just earlier this year. Loads of people last year said, "Oh, you have to read Welcome to Glorious Tuga," and I was like, "It's on my list. It's on my list." And I will get to it. I'll get to it. And then earlier this year, I got both of the books. Your second one came out earlier this year, Island Calling, and I had them both. I took them on my honeymoon to Ireland. It rained the whole week. I spent the week reading. Honestly, it was like there couldn't have been a more perfect book choices for my honeymoon. I read them back to back.
I'm so pleased.
It was everything that people told me they would be, you know, joyous, uplifting, very funny, all those things. But what was interesting is that I also had seen quite a few places describe it as escapist. And that word didn't really feel quite right to me. And I wanted to ask you about that because in my paperback copy of Welcome to Glorious Tuga, the first book, you have it. There's a little something you've added to the front about talking about this idea of Tuga was a refuge for the first settlers that went there, and that you hope that it's a refuge for readers too. And it just felt like refuge was such a better word for what you've created here rather than escapist. And I just love to hear your thoughts on how you feel about being described as escapist.
It's such a loaded word, isn't it? And I think that's where it becomes problematic. Also, because it's important in fiction to have shorthand that corresponds to genre, to shelves, so that readers understand what they're getting into. And I have great respect for escapist fiction as a category, but I do think it. I think because of all the freighting of that word and the expectations that come along with it, I don't think it's necessarily a great fit, because I wouldn't want readers to come to these books expecting nothing bad ever to happen, expecting it to be only a sort of sunny, positive space in which everything is sort of wrapped up in a neat bow. And there's a great place for all that. Like, this is not, there's no judgment intended about any of those books.
Definitely.
When I say that, but it is, you know, it was very much intended as a refuge, as you say. And I think there is a great place always, and particularly now, for fiction that gives hope and gives us hope for humanity. And these books were a space that I very deliberately wanted to and chose to construct in which there was a kind of fundamental human kindness assumed, and a sort of a contract with the reader to leave them more hopeful than I found them. But having said that, along that journey, there are some pretty challenging issues with women's healthcare. There is still human betrayal, and people lie and cheat and are exactly as we know people to be. And there isn't necessarily always going to be like a sort of straightforward arc of a kind of classic beach romance novel. So I think escapist can be, I hope it provides an escape, lowercase, without necessarily, I wouldn't reach for the word escapist.
I think that's such a beautiful way of putting it. I looked back on it after I read it and I was like, there is so much beauty and joy in it, but there is also a sharp edge. There's an edge in there. And I think it's that combination of the edge and that the dark and the light in there that makes it feel so hopeful in a way, because there's not a denying of the fact that difficult things happen, even in really quite incredible communities.
Well, I think that's the thing. I think, you know, we have to, it's like, everything's going to be okay in the end, rather, you know, or regardless kind of thing. You know, it'll all turn out all right somehow.
Yeah.
Rather than, and they all lived happily ever after.
Yes. Yes. And that's what it feels like this world encapsulates in many ways. And it's funny, actually, I felt it had, rather than things in common with what you say is like books that are described with capital E escapist, more actually in common with 19th century literature and early 20th century literature, you know, like, you know, kind of whole worlds like Dickens and E.M. Forster, where you get kind of whole communities together, and they're very funny, and they're not without their darkness. They're with, you know, we're looking at all these relationships and all these sort of interconnected communities with humor and light, but also with that darkness as well.
I love that you say that, because that's basically my spiritual home, and that's where I read. I think I am sort of like a misplaced like 19th century novelist. It's, someone once said to me, why, like, would you ever consider writing out of like the sort of close third? Mm-hmm. And I honestly had to pause, because I was like, but why would I ever leave the close, like, that's where I live. That's where the 19th century voice is. And that is very much, those are the novels that I reach for, like Middlemarch, that kind of complete sense of a world and a community and the expansiveness of it. Or I'm reading now for the first time, reading my first Anthony Trollope at the moment. I'm reading The Way We Live Now. And that is just like, it's this huge, it's a world, it's a whole community. And I'm driving my family mad at the moment, because I'm really at this point where I'm just snatching 2 minutes standing up just to figure out what's going to, like, is Sir Felix Carbery going to get his comeuppance? I can almost think about nothing else. So those are the books that I reach for solace, to laugh, to think, to, and so that is, it is gorgeous to me that you've sort of identified even a tiny echo of that shape of a book.
Yeah, it does feel like, it does remind me of something like A Room with a View is one of my favorite books.
Oh, I love that.
There is something about just the all of the characters and all of the connectedness between them, but also all of the sort of asides and the swiping and the little bit of snarkiness and the humor, but also the kind of things that are the undercurrents sort of that's going under all of these sorts of things. And it did feel, it had a really similar feel in that you could just be immersed in this world. And I guess I wanted to ask a little bit about the choosing this particular world to set it in, because it does feel almost like another time because they're so physically isolated. It isn't another time. And I found that really, really interesting, this idea that like you've got this world that is quite slow and in kind of old-fashioned in some ways, but the thing that's quite amazing is the values aren't necessarily old-fashioned values.
That was quite a deliberate choice, because when I was thinking about the kind of constructing of this space, and this is really like very much, I mean, every novel involves world building, but this is very much my first foray into the kind of real traditional world building in that sense of like constructing a climate and a place and a community and the values and the history, and that has been incredible. And so obviously one thing I was thinking is, you know, when are we, is this actually going to be a historical novel? But I was so urgently in need of a kind of exit from contemporary reality, and for me going backwards just made me feel like this juggernaut of everything would still be coming at me. Like however far back I went, the future was still where we are. And so I wanted this kind of sidestep out so that it could be now, but just far enough away. Mm. And also so that, you know, the beauty of creating an island is that I get to play God.
Yeah.
So one of the first things I've done is cancel God. They're all humanists. But as part of playing God, I could take the kind of gentleness of like a Heriot world. I love James Heriot, and that was part of like a clear sort of he's a clear ancestor here in this novel. But I also was like, you know what, actually I can have some contemporary, I can bring contemporary values, we don't have to go back. Like I don't think anyone would argue that things were better for women if we go backwards. And things are not perfect for women on Tuga now in particular. And that was something I was really interested to think about and explore, was women's healthcare and what the care looked like. But I thought, you know, actually I can build this to order as a kind of wish fulfillment. And I can take the gentleness and the kindness and the community and the dances and the lovely traditional values, and I can leave behind, and we don't have to go back in time in there. It doesn't have to be retrogressive and constrained in that way. We can have, it can just be better.
Yeah, I love that. It's just, as a total aside, I have this thing on Instagram where I don't know if you ever do this, but like there's a couple of things I follow that have nothing to do with me, nothing to do with what I do, nothing to do with my own hobbies. Of like, there are some costume designers that I follow that I just love following, because they show you how they construct all of these costumes. But a number of them have in their bios, because they've had to make it very clear, you know, so retro costumes, not retro values, because sometimes people assume if you're dressing up in something from the 1940s and 1950s, you might also have some kind of political values that go along with that.
Interesting. I never would have connected those two things, but why, you know, if you're harking back to the good old days.
Yeah, exactly. So they kind of, some of them had to make it very clear that, you know, like, yes, I can build from scratch myself a costume from an Edwardian costume, but no, it's not like I'm, you know, want to be back there in terms of all the values, yeah, that and time enclosed. But what is so interesting is I'm kind of reluctant to use the word utopia, but there are some utopic elements to the community in the sense that, as you said, you've made it a humanist community instead of one where kind of religion dominates, which I found completely fascinating. There's also a mix of race in terms of the founders who came there, and they came from also different classes, which was amazing. And I would love to just ask you a little bit about how that came together in your world building, where it was very early on you knew that the kind of people that you wanted to have fed into this community early on, or was that sort of something that kind of, I guess, piece together as you went?
It's sort of, there's a powerful component of wish fulfillment in my construction of this place. And so, you know, and I was beginning with a blank canvas because it was also very important to me that I was not like, this is not a colonial novel. This is not an island that had a native population and I'm bringing a bunch of outsiders to it. It was an uninhabited island. Mm. And everybody who settled there was in need of refuge.
And that
was a sort of, and as soon as I understood that in my own mind as a motivation for all these groups, it was clear to me that who I would bring. So there were the Sephardim fleeing persecution under the Portuguese, and if lots of those families sailed to the Dutch West Indies, and if you sail from Brazil to the Dutch West Indies, you hit Tugadoro. Mm-hmm. So they were early settlers. There's also Igbo slaves from Nigeria, and I wanted them safe too and rescued. And then some refugees during the Second World War, and basically every single founding population and shipwrecked sailors, everyone who needed it could come, really. That was my fantasy.
Yeah.
And come together and make this collectivist community where everybody takes care of each other. But there's also like amazing germs of, not that in particular, but, you know, we do have, there is a collectivist British Overseas Territory in the South Atlantic. Tristan da Cunha runs on collectivist values. And if your family lose a cow, the Island Council will help you to get another cow. You know, that's, they have amazing resources to take care of one another on that island. And, you know, there's an agreement that each family will only have a certain amount of livestock because there's only a certain amount of grazing space. And people work together generally in the kind of lobster fisheries around Tristan. But there's also island days where everyone downs tools and does government work. And so lots of these collectivist practices are also taken from, you know, real communities.
It makes it even better, actually, knowing that it's in practice in some places around the world. Yeah, that's just really incredible. So in terms of your cast, and it's funny, I do sort of think of it as a cast, and you've even put a dramatis personae in the beginning of the book.
Oh, we went back and forth about that a lot.
I love
it. Some people hate them. Some people see that and they're like, oh, too many people, I don't want this book. And some people are like, I love a cast list.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And so how did that cast of characters come together? What was your route in to kind of developing who you needed in this community?
That's really interesting. I do think it actually evolved, like almost kind of as I walked around inside my head, I would think, well, suddenly, you know, I'd kind of go further into the story and I'd think, well, of course there's a teacher, who's the teacher? And of course, you know, I need somebody, you know, who are the farmers, who's running the general store, and it kind of like almost kind of came into being as I moved through it. Mm. And then the characters came from kind of almost, I guess, what was needed. Like as Charlotte kind of cast her eyes into different zones of the island, they would kind of animate for me. And then that thing of, you know, having a first draft where you've planned out everything you think everyone's going to do, and then you get to know your characters a little bit better and you understand their psychology and their deeper motivations beyond who you've, you know, the kind of the initial ideas you have for them. And then you realize that everything you have them doing has to change because they're actually driven by an entirely different engine from the one that you had sort of designated to them. And that's where things get sort of interesting and challenging and fun, I suppose.
That's something I'd love to ask you about, actually, in terms of how you approach fiction. Did you go in when you started your first draft with a sort of a sketch outline or a very detailed outline about how you were going to write that first book? Or do you go in with a sort of open-ended, like, do you know the direction you're going when you begin and let it happen?
No, I hate that open-ended thing. I feel very insecure. So I do lots of planning and I have a sort of unbelievably destabilizing and chaotic system of nothing and everything. So I have like Excel spreadsheets, pieces of A2 paper, you know, Word documents, notebooks, and stuff half planned everywhere. And I ultimately do end up with a sort of a plan for each chapter. And then I deviate from it.
Yeah.
Basically. So I have this plan in place and then writing through it, attempting to be methodical and quite literally ticking off chapter after chapter. I then put things in the bin, move them around, realize none of it makes sense, change the ending. But I need that kind of, it's almost like a Dumbo's feather. Like I think I would feel very frightened to jump without having those plans. That
yeah, it's like having a map, isn't it? So you like you know the direction you're going in, but you know you decide to take a different route along the way, and then you take a different route along the way.
Yes, and it's been so interesting with this because I've never written interconnected novels before. But I, you know, I had the rough outline of book three even when I was writing book one because I knew from quite early on that this I wanted to expand beyond the canvas of one book. But similar things have happened in that, you know, I've left loose ends that I know need to be resolved and I know how to resolve them, but I also expected certain things from characters in book three. And then their choices and behaviors in book two have made those things I planned for them completely impossible. So that's been interesting because it turns out you can't edit books once they're published.
Yeah, that's... that must be the most terrifying thing about bringing out a series of books in the same world is that you built your world and you built your characters and you have to live with them to a certain extent.
Yeah. Yeah. And also for somebody who has been very sort of high-handed and protective of my creative space when I'm early in a project and when my first drafts are sterile and nobody gets to talk to me about them and nobody gets to look at them. But now I've had this very humbling and actually incredible experience of, you know, I'm writing something live now and readers are responding to these characters and these stories because the other books are out.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Yes.
So that's been really interesting. And I think it's been really good for me because I've had to just get off my sort of high horse and also realize that other people have really good ideas, really good insights. And it's actually really amazing to fold in other people's observations. But it is really interesting to be working with something that is absolutely set in stone up until the end of book two. And then obviously everything else is to play for, but I can't suddenly change someone's motivation or go back into their history and change their, you know.
Oh my goodness. Is it, apart from being a bit perhaps scary because it's a different approach, has it been in some ways a little bit freeing because of the constraints that you're working with constraints now that you haven't worked with on book three? You're working with constraints you've never worked with before. Has it been quite good to have those constraints? Is that like just a different experience?
Yes, I think so. And I think it's really like, I think it's really good to stretch and work and like push yourself slightly out of your comfort zone. And this book three, so book one and two run together in quite a continuous, there's like 6 weeks between those two books. But book three is 9 years later.
Oh,
and also goes back really far, goes back like 60 years. So it kind of wraps around both those first two books. Oh. And just the intellectual exercise of keeping all these threads in place is really exciting and also really, really frustrating because real life is so intrusive. And I have actually expected to be a person most of the time. And that does get in the way.
Yeah. It is because also there is quite a cast of characters like Charlotte's our kind of way into this world. But there are so many other really important characters in the book. You're holding a number of threads anyway, even within each novel. But you're also then holding the threads of a trilogy at the same time as well. So, yeah, that's a lot to hold in one time.
Yes.
Are we going to get book number three in 2026? Is that, you're not sure? You're not allowed to say.
I think 2026 would be a stretch.
Okay. We might wait. It'll be worth the wait.
We say, I think 2027, there'll be paperback book two, 2026, and I think book three, 2027, but we'll see.
Amazing. I would love to go a little bit further back now to your memoir that came out in 2019, Mothership, about your experience of being in NICU with your twin daughters for 56 days. We were just chatting before we started recording about how I read it back in 2019, but I listened for the first time, actually, to the audiobook this past week. And I have to say, once again, I was just so completely astonished by being immersed in this experience with you. And it does really feel like you're the reader, like as a reader, it feels like we're really with you with that experience. And I just wanted to ask you a little bit about that, because I've heard you in the past say that you absolutely never expected ever to write memoir or nonfiction. So I just want to ask you a little bit about like what tipped the balance for you. Was it that it just wouldn't let you alone and you couldn't not do it? Was that what happened in the end?
Thank you for saying such incredibly generous things about it. Yeah, it was funny. I mean, I never ever thought I would write memoir. I've really never. I even really resist that thing that women who write are often, in fact, always expected to do, which is to write promotional essays about some element of themselves to promote fiction, which is invented and has no relation to their own lives. Mm. I really don't enjoy that element of self-exposure at all, which is why I'm so rubbish at social media and all that stuff. And so it was not my natural territory to write anything quite so personal. And basically sort of as soon as, you know, the girls, as you said, spent 56 days in hospital and then they were discharged. And then, you know, a point came when it was clear that they were fine and we were fine. And people began to ask me the perfectly reasonable question, are you going to write about it?
Mm.
Because I'm a writer and writers, you know, are often engaged with big experiences like that. And I just said no. And I not only did I say no, I kind of didn't even allow myself to consider whether I would or wouldn't. It was just an absolute no. And then when the girls were two, they were discharged from consultant care. You don't leave NICU immediately. You leave and you go home, but then you're back 3 days later for ophthalmology and cardiology and audiology and all the other ologies. And you're kind of pinging back and forth. And our consultant who took care of us as outpatients for those years afterwards was the same consultant who had admitted us when we were transferred to our second hospital. So you maintain this relationship that feels very bound up in that NICU experience for a long time. And then suddenly there was this day that came very unexpectedly where he basically put mortarboards on the pair of them and was like, you graduate, you are now babies, goodbye. You're fine. You don't need me. Be free. And that's an immense privilege that, and we were incredibly lucky that at that point, everything was mostly wound up. There was, you know, it was over. Yeah. As an experience, it had a shape. And obviously there will be legacies for us and for them that are unquantifiable. Mm. But it was a story with an ending, suddenly. And almost immediately, I felt different about it. I know lots of people talk about writing for catharsis, and for me that would be private writing, but I understood only when it was closed as an experience and I could process it as something that had a shape that I was okay.
Mm.
And being okay, I could thereby reflect, and that reflection was what I felt had value.
Yeah.
Not kind of learning how I felt by writing about it. I don't think that's something I do. I know people do, and it's enormously valuable to follow with them. But for me, I need the opposite. I need to understand what I think and then to explore it on the page a bit. And I had these private diaries, and I had vast tracts of WhatsApp communications, both with my husband and with the other women who were in the hospital, that gave this natural shape to it. And then I had lunch with two writers who just said, you have to write this book. I think you have to write this. Like, I think this could be of value to people going through it, or it might, you know, just do it and see. And I left that lunch and I walked to the hospital and I filed the like data thing to, I submitted the data thing to get a copy of their notes. And then this sort of, these two archive boxes were presented to me. I suddenly having come on public transport to get an Uber home because I couldn't carry this weight of paper. And even just physically having those documents made me think, okay, I think I'm doing this. Like, I think this is quite decisive now. And it just happened. And it was, having been the hardest thing I'd lived through, the easiest book I've written, strangely.
So interesting, isn't it? It's so interesting. I so relate to this idea of not writing as catharsis in terms of the writing you share. My first book is about unpaid care, and it's not memoir, in terms, it's not a memoir, but it has a lot of memoir in it. And I very much could not start that book until I had come to terms with having a child with a lifelong disability. That had to happen first. I couldn't even look at it. In fact, I remember the first few times when the idea that I would write a book about and using the word unpaid care as a topic that I would write about, the absolute physical resistance I felt inside me, which I say to people now and they're like, what? But like, you wrote a whole, like, how did I? I'm like, it started with resistance, believe me.
Also, you're busy. You were living it.
Yeah.
Like, being in it, you like, who wants to write about it? You were busy existing.
Well, exactly. I was like, maybe I want to write about something totally not to do with everything I have to do every single day in my life.
Yeah. And then slow change is so interesting because it's a journey of, as you said, it's a kind of.
Coming to this other place. And then I realized the way I felt about it was so different. And I could see other people looking to me and saying, but how do you feel differently about it now?
Yes.
And then that's what drove the writing of that book was, I'll sort of show you how I came to these sort of, I guess, to kind of acceptance of all of this in a way.
And but, that's the value. That's enormous value for other people.
Yeah, huge amount of value. And what was so interesting about listening to Mothership again was, you know, I've not had that physical experience of early parenthood that you had. But as somebody who has had a very different kind of parenthood, and, you know, my child's disability wasn't really kind of identified till his second year and really wasn't confirmed until his sort of third year of life. And it happened over a very long, slow period of time, which actually with a lot of disabled kids, that happens. In fact, I've spoken to a lot of families with disabled children who have said, no one's ever even said to them, no medical professional said, oh, you have a disabled child now. It's happened so gradually and slowly and pieced together. But there was so much in your experience that I could relate to in that lack of control, you know, that being controlled by a system and having to submit to people who know better, like, you know better in quote marks, and this idea of having some of that agency as a mother taken away from you. I just thought it was so interesting how in these different experiences of motherhood, actually there is so much in common that we all have with each other in these very specific moments.
I think that's right. And I think another thing that's probably analogous is that journey from absolute and total shock and ignorance and a total lack of understanding of anything to that inevitable point that will come at some point anywhere along that journey of anyone who's parenting a child who has any form of additional medical needs of actually being the world expert in your child. And that will come. And that will be the point at which, you know, you're not a doctor. And at no point do any of us think that we are, but you are the world expert in this child and this child's needs. And you will be the only person who can answer specific questions and who's observant about certain things. And that is that journey, I think, is in common across any of these distinct and sort of parallel parenting experiences.
One thing that I was really struck by listening to it again as well, after having read the first two Tuga books, is that I wonder if Tuga wouldn't have existed without that experience in a way.
That's really interesting. I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that's true.
There was something about the isolation that you experienced and that intensity, particularly with the other mothers who were going through exactly the same thing, the incredible support that was built up, you built up around each other. But then also, the whole outside world not really being able to exist actually for that period of time for you. Yeah.
I think that's really insightful and I hadn't ever thought about it, but I'm sure that you're right.
But in a way, it's like I can see the same kind of hope in Mothership as I can see in the Tuga books, like in the sense of like when we need it, that there will be people around us that will help carry us when we need it.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that's that it's that sort of hope for and belief in the village in whatever form that we can build it, and probably the reading beneath that, you know, the kind of Adrian Rich, the hopes of a, you know, women taking care of women in a shape elastic enough that everybody's needs are met under imperfect circumstances. I'm sure that's true.
I want to just talk briefly about how things have changed for you over the years, because your first book, The Innocence, came out in 2012. And you weren't a mother then. You since became a mother, obviously in a quite sort of dramatic way, and a very dramatic, I guess, would have been a very dramatic year or two. I want to ask you a little bit about how your kind of day-to-day life as a writer has changed. And, you know, just like what we were talking about before, this idea of, you know, the Tuga books, you're holding so many threads in your mind as you're writing book number three. And you've obviously got three children and a whole other life, as we all have whole other lives. How has that shifted and changed, and how have you, I guess, come to terms with those shifts and changes as a creative, as a writer?
I don't think I have come to terms with them, actually. I think I really rail against them still. Partly I'm my own worst enemy. So just in practical terms, I have, we have no additional childcare apart from school. So my husband takes the kids to school every morning at 8 o'clock. He does drop off, which means my working day starts at 8, but I do pick up every day, which means I stand up from my desk at 2:30. Then my working day is 8 till 2:30. And that is lovely, but it's never enough, because obviously I waste a huge amount of that time buying school tights and paying the ballet teacher and, you know, dealing with the fact that the dishwasher won't close and everything else that we're all dealing with. And I procrastinate enormously and then hate myself. And hating myself takes up like at least 30% of my working day. I need to do it very intensely, resent my own procrastination, sort of curse my own inefficiency. I would say that's almost the majority of my working hours are spent that way. And then, you know, the girls come home and then I'm with them until they go to bed. And what's changed, and this acceptance that like, motherhood is constantly in flux and parenthood is always changing, and just when you think, you know, you have stable ground beneath you, things are shifting. I was heavily, heavily dependent upon that evening shift for work. My children went to bed at 7:30 and I would work from 7:30 until 11, six nights a week. And in all of this, there's almost no life, there's almost no socializing, there's no time outside of work and children. But that was the structure, and that's how most of these books subsequent to my children being born have been written. And now my eldest two are nearly 10 and they don't go to bed at 7:30 anymore.
It stopped happening.
Stopped happening, and they want to have really serious and important and meaningful talks about what's happened in their day at bedtime.
Yeah.
And I can't start at 9:45. I should be able to. I want to be Anne Michaels, who's always giving these incredible interviews saying, you know, if everyone's asleep above me, I can work from midnight till 3. But I can't. I'm tired.
I mean, the fact that for years you worked from 7:30 to 11, to me, I find quite astonishing, because I'm always so enamored by night owls. I really am. But I am definitely not at my best in the evening.
I don't think I'm necessarily at my best, but there was a kind of, there's a mental calm that comes from knowing everyone was asleep.
Yes, and their needs were met. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And also, which I think was a gift, but also as a curse in our household, my husband is also a workaholic and was working the same hours and was grateful that I was disappearing to my desk, because it gave him permission to disappear to his. Yeah. And so there is no work-life balance in that model. Mm-hmm.
So going forward, you're working on book three, but you always knew it was going to be a trilogy. And so this will be for you the close of this particular world. Yeah. Do you think the next steps for you beyond this will be something just totally, totally different? Or are you not quite prepared to think that far ahead?
I think I'm always guilty of that very powerful grass is always greener longing for the kind of this other creative stage. So thinking when I'm on a deadline, finishing a book, the freedom and liberty of being out of contract and having just an open field, what bliss. But actually, that is when I am hardest to live with, and I am just crashing around the house in a terrible mood because I'm out of contract. Nobody's ever going to print a word I write again. I'm never going to have another idea. I am basically just going to languish in a life that has no creative outlet at all, and it's all over. But from where I'm sitting now, I think, how lovely, I'll finish this and then I could write anything.
The freedom.
The freedom. Whereas actually what I need to be telling myself every day is that, no, a deadline is a gift. Contract is a gift. Someone expecting something in the real world is a gift. Mm. Because it's very easy to just go utterly off the rails alone with a creative project that nobody's seen or knows about. Mm. And to feel like you've sort of lost your way a bit. So to have someone who actually knows what you're doing and expects you to deliver it is, I think it's probably very grounding. But yeah, after this, I don't know. It's very, I will really, really miss this island a lot. Yeah. It's been a gift to be able to go there in my imagination.
Yeah. When I started reading the first book, very quickly, I don't know how far in, but very quickly, I was like, oh, thank God, this is a trilogy. Just immediately as a reader, which I know is very different because it's super easy to read a few books and delightful and much harder to actually create them. But yeah, I can imagine after pouring all of that time and energy into this place and these incredible cast of characters to leave them behind, I'm sure is going to be.
I think it will be quite strange. Yeah. But I think I probably have to resist the urge to stay there and just think I need to write another one. I think I need to be quite grown up and say, no, this has a shape and an end.
But I also love that. I am one of those, maybe I'm slightly unusual in this, but I, for instance, don't like TV shows that go on forever. They drive me slightly.
No, I agree with that, actually.
I love them to have the right shape for the story they're telling. And so that sort of more American style of thing of like, oh, we're on season number 9. I'm like, I switched off after season 4 or whatever, because, you know, it was a really nice natural ending there, but then you just kept going.
Yeah, and you don't want everything dismantled that's been slotted into a satisfying place just for the sake of constructing further. I think that's right.
Yeah. Well, Francesca, thank you so much for chatting with me today. These books are just, oh, incredible worlds to immerse yourself in. I want everyone to read them. And thank you again for Mothership. I mean, just the most incredible memoir, just absolutely beautiful. I'm so glad I went back there. It was so nice actually to revisit it. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been a total joy.